Right, we've had our panel change, and we are back with you all. We are ready for the second case on our docket, if our clerk will call it. Are you all ready to proceed? Okay.
Yes.
The court will now call William P. Garrett and Linda Garrett. May I please report, Mr. Michael Alford will argue for the appellant. Mr. Jared Phillips will argue for the appellant.
Mr. Alford?
May I approach?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the court and opposing counsel, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I think this is an interesting case, and I want to make sure I'm not talking too loud here into the microphone. I represent Todd and Lynetta Garrett, and I think the underlying facts are relatively undisputed here. My client purchased some property out near Lake Granbury in the Scenic View Estates about a year and a half ago or so, and began to make short-term rental arrangements through Vacation Rentals by Owner, commonly known as VRBO. They started that in February of 2016 and continued it all the way through July of last year, when the plaintiffs filed their lawsuit and sought and obtained a temporary injunction that, in short, prohibited the short-term rental arrangements that the Garretts were engaging in. I think the primary issue in this case, then, is whether the restrictive covenants that govern the property that my clients purchased near Lake Granbury prohibit short-term rentals when there's nothing in the restrictive covenants that expressly prohibit that type of behavior or conduct. The restrictions, importantly, only limit the use of the property to single-family dwelling purposes. And I think the purposes is an important word in that phrase, but only limit the property's use to single-family dwelling purposes, and expressly contemplates the rental of property, because in the restrictive covenants there is a provision that says that owners can erect or display a for rent sign subject to certain size limitations. So respectfully, I think it's fairly obvious that rental or leasing arrangements can be allowed on the property. Otherwise, there would be no need to allow the display of for rent signs. Importantly, there are no durational or time limits or restrictions on the rental of property under these deed restrictions, just none. And single family dwelling purposes is not defined. The single family dwelling purposes provision is just not defined anywhere in the deed restrictions. So in order to, and I also should add that there are durational limitations on other aspects in the covenants, such as the covenants contemplate that you might be constructing a new property on a lot, and you might need a temporary facility to live in that would be incident to or adjacent, but maybe not affixed to the actual dwelling. Well, there's a time limitation on how long that structure can remain on the property, but there is no time limitation or any restrictions whatsoever on the rental of properties other than the undefined term single family dwelling purposes. So in the absence of any such restrictions, my clients believe there should be no prohibition against short-term rentals on the property. I think one of the important things for the panel to determine in adjudicating this case is, what is the framework that the panel is going to use? The plaintiffs are relying on Texas Property Code 202.003A, that's a mouthful, which basically, I think, provides a restrictive covenant shall be liberally construed to give effect to its purposes and intent. However, common law, as established through precedent by this court in the Hoover case, and I can provide the citation if necessary, but it's in our brief, as well as the recently adjudicated or decided Reed case from 2016, Hoover was in 2001, I believe, and the Texas Property Code 202.003A, I think, was enacted in 1997. But common law dictates that in interpreting, construing a restrictive covenant, all doubts are to be resolved in favor of the free and unrestricted use of the property, and any ambiguity is to be strictly construed against the party seeking to enforce it. So we've got a question as to the framework, as to which kind of trumps which here, if the court finds there's any ambiguity. And I think that this court in Hoover and in Reed has already established and given the template here that if the provision, the restrictive covenant, is unambiguous, then the Texas Property Code applies. If there's any doubt or ambiguity involved in the restrictive covenant, the common law applies to resolve those doubts in favor of the unrestricted and free use of the property and construing against the party seeking to enforce the covenant any ambiguity it will be resolved against that party. I would also add that in the Hoover case, there's a very important provision that dovetails with this, and that is that words in a restrictive covenant, and this is regardless of any ambiguity or not, this is just a straight rule of construction, words used in a restrictive covenant may not be enlarged, extended, stretched, or changed by construction. And that's on page 308 of the Hoover opinion, 39 Southwest 3D 300, 2001. So what does that mean? Well, that means that courts cannot legislate or create words in a deed restriction that are otherwise not there. And the only way, my client's position, rather, is the only way that we get to the injunction that the trial court rendered is we have to start creating, and it, frankly, I think it goes even further than enlarging, extending, or stretching, but we actually have to change and create new words to impose time limitations or the types of individuals that this property can be rented to.
Doesn't it really just come down to whether or not single-family residential purposes, whether short-term rentals of weekends are residential?
I think that's the primary issue, Your Honor. I think that's the primary issue. And here, the question is going to be, is that capable of multiple interpretations or meanings, or is that so clear there can only be one meaning? Because under the Zagby case, which I think is most directly on point here, it's the similarities are striking, because in the Zagby case out of Austin, for which the Supreme Court denied review, you had the same almost exact deed restriction language for single family dwelling purposes. You had the capability of a for rent sign in the yard, and you had durational limits on the a temporary structure while your home was being built. That's identical to what we have in this case. And in the Zagby case, under footnote 4, the Austin Court of Appeals found multiple definitions of single-family dwelling purposes. I believe under Webster's Dictionary, Black's Law's Dictionary, and there was another...
But here it says residential, not dwelling.
Correct. And, you know, I believe also in the Bernard opinion, in the dissent, Justice Burgess, and frankly, that opinion I think is interesting because I think they applied the differing standard of the Texas property code versus the common law as Hoover and the Reed decisions have established for this court. But in that Bernard opinion, Justice Burgess in his dissent found that residential could be multifamily dwelling, apartments, condominiums, townhomes. So, but I do think, Justice Walker, yes, to answer your question, I think it's going to come down to what does single-family dwelling purposes mean? Can that mean short-term rentals? Can it mean any kind of rental?
It says residential, and I think that's the appellee's argument, is that residential means residence.
And I would say also that Justice Burgess in his dissent said residential can also mean single-family dwelling, apartment complexes, which obviously you have renters in those apartment complex-type buildings, townhomes. multifamily scenarios, so that goes beyond just the traditional family. Additionally, the Texas Supreme Court has also, in the context of residential, has in the Southampton Civic Club v. Couch case from 1958, and this is where we get into the analogous discussion in our brief about having the Full House family or the Golden Girls being able to live in a house like this under those types of conditions. We can't be using definitions of residential that would yield an impractical result. So, and I think, though, what is critical here is two things, I think, with respect to the residential. If the court finds that residential is capable of multiple meanings, then now we are under Hoover and Reed standards of all doubts must be resolved in favor of the free and unrestricted use of the property. Beg your pardon. And any ambiguity must be strictly construed against the party seeking to enforce it, which is the plaintiffs here. Secondly, if the court finds that residential is not ambiguous, then but would include a rental arrangement, then now we can't come into, or at least what Reed and Hoover would say, we can't come in and enlarge, extend, or stretch or change the wording of the covenant. And if the court finds there's ambiguity, though, between residential and having the for rent sign ability under the deed restrictions here, then again, we're back to an ambiguity. So I guess I would like to kind of add a nuance to, does it just turn down to the definition of residential? Because if the court were to find residential did not include rental arrangements, then how do we reconcile having the crafters, the drafters of the restrictions allowing for a for rent sign to be displayed in the yard? Obviously, there was a contemplation by the drafters that leasing arrangements would be allowable. It would not be considered a rental arrangement. And I think that's a good contrast to the Munson case that the plaintiffs rely upon. In the Munson case, which then is followed by Bernard, which then is followed by the Tarr opinion out of San Antonio. But in the Munson case, the drafters of those restrictive covenants actually went so far as to say, look, residential does not include motels, tourist courts, which I was unfamiliar with that term until I read that opinion, but tourist courts and trailer parks. So by definition, the drafters in the Bernard case obviously felt that residential purposes needed to be further defined to clarify it did not include those activities. Otherwise, it could have, would be the logic. So, from Munson, you get to Bernard and then Tarr, and I don't think Tarr or Bernard took the time to differentiate or distinguish or appreciate, maybe it's a better word, the fact that Munson had the four corners language of its restrictive covenants was very much different than what we have here and what we had in the Zagby case. You had a special carve-out for those activities that the drafters in Munson wanted to make clear were not part of quote-unquote residential or single-family dwelling purposes. So I think it's important to note also in Bernard, the court itself acknowledged that if it had applied the standard of the required by the precedent in Hoover and in Reed from this court of the common law standard of strictly construing in all doubts in favor of the unrestricted and free use of property, it would have reached a much different result and, in fact, would have been in line with the Zagby court. Instead, it said that the Texas Property Code, unlike what the Fort Worth Court of Appeals has held, is going to trump the common law. But that's not the standard with the Fort Worth Court of Appeals here. So I think it's very interesting to compare the cases that the plaintiffs are relying on, both from a factual distinguishing perspective, as well as the legal standard being used in Tarr, well, not in Tarr, but in Bernard and Munson. I think those are very important facts that the court should, or not facts, but legal standards, rather, that should not be applied in this case. So at this time, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if it pleases the court.
Thank you.
Good afternoon to the court, counsel. I'm here today to speak on behalf of Kay Simpson and Clifford Hall, the appellees in this case. And it won't surprise the panel to know that we disagree with a good part of what he said. I don't think the facts are in dispute. Mr. Garrett admitted that when he bought the property, he knew that there was this restriction, but he sort of unilaterally decided, based on the advice of his realtor, that it didn't apply to him. We think that, as Justice Walker has questioned, that this turns on the word residential. A residential purpose means that you are there to stay and create a home, to reside, not just to stay for a temporary period of time. Failing that, we believe it's also a commercial use by this particular homeowner. There are several points that lend themselves to this evaluation. The first is the construction of the deed restriction. We've talked about the liberal construction and the strict construction, but we also have to go a little bit farther. You have to review this covenant at the time it was written. In 1967, there was no internet. There was no vacation rental by owner. There was no contemplation of this. You might as well have put an alien in Granbury, Texas. And that would have been just about as far-fetched as a computer that would let you rent anything to anybody at any point in time. So taking this in 1967 in suburban Texas, where these framers of this deed restriction wanted to maintain this small neighborhood, 30 to 40 homes, as a neighborhood of single-family residential uses. We also have to look at the manner in which this was written. If you look in the Texas Government Code, there are a couple of chapters or sections that devote themselves to what words mean. You give words their ordinary meaning unless it's a term of art. I am inclined to think that single family resident is a term of art. You see it in zoning issues. It is clearly different than multifamily. It is not apartments. It is not condos. It is not the rental to multiple families in one dwelling. And as taking it a step further, the Texas Property Code makes it pretty clear in my reading. A restrictive covenant shall be liberally construed to give effect to its purposes and intent. Well, in law school, we were taught that the word shall differed from the word may, that the word all differed from the word any. If you use that construction, shall creates, according to section 311, I think 016, shall imposes a duty. That would indicate to me that this court has a duty to impose a liberal construction on this particular restrictive covenant.
Does it matter for our analysis that the restrictive covenant here doesn't have any time duration?
I don't think it does, because I think the difference is that if you're talking about apples and oranges, the time that you would put to allow somebody to have a temporary structure on a property while they're building another structure has a particular purpose. You don't want them to start building today and in 3 years they're still building. So they put a restriction on that. But just because they could put a restriction on that, and keep in mind, we're talking 1967. There is no contemplation by the framers that people are going to rent their house for a week or a day or a weekend. They're going to rent it to a family who's going to come there, create a home, and reside there. So you have to take those two together. Now, Mr. Offord refers to the Zagby case. That restrictive covenant was written 32 years after the restrictive covenant in this case.
And is it another difference between the restrictive covenant here and the one in Zagabe, is that here we have explicit prohibition regarding commercial use of the property, but that wasn't in the covenant in the Zagabe, was it? Or am I misreading?
I'm not going to tell you that I remember that. I did not focus on that element in Zagabe, but I believe that they focus really just on the residential use. In this case, it does say that it cannot be used for commercial purposes. Mr. Alford referenced that because Munson went on to include trailer parks, motels, and the like, that they intended to make that more specific and say, if these things are there, then, you know, they're prohibited. But it also, because they would be commercial in nature, but it doesn't say that you can't have a machine shop, but is a machine shop any less of a commercial use? But just because it doesn't say it, doesn't mean that it's not a commercial use. If the framers of any restrictive covenant had to go along and contemplate every single possible use so they could either prohibit it or allow it, they would never get to the end of the restrictive covenant. And again, we go back to 1967. These things could not have even been contemplated at that point in time. This is like, for those of you that might be familiar with the Big Bang Theory, Sheldon's roommate agreement that covers if aliens come, then I get to be the first one to meet them, or, you know, something equally silly. But framers of restrictive covenants weren't thinking like that. And I don't see how we can put a standard on the framers of the restrictive covenant to address what they didn't know and could not have known at that point in time. I do think it really comes down to the single-family residential use. They refer to the opportunity to rent the property. We don't deny that the property can be rented. We don't believe it can be used for a commercial purpose. In this situation, these folks have rented this property. They pay a hotel tax. A hotel by its nature is a commercial use. If you're paying a hotel tax, then you're renting in such a manner that it constitutes a commercial use. If you rent to a single family for a period of time, like, and I'm going to use an apartment as an example, not because this could be done that way, but you rent it for 6 months or a year or 3 years, you don't pay taxes. The hotel tax is for anything under 30 days. So that further distinguishes this from residential and commercial. But the rental signage was intended, I mean, it says you can have a 4x4 sign or whatever the particular restriction is, but it doesn't talk about computer distribution of rental availability. Again, something they could not have contemplated. So it derives down to, what is the rental is for what purpose? The single family residential purpose is allowed and not contested. I think everybody agrees based on these facts that rentals can occur. But the act of conducting daily living activities, taking a shower, sleeping, eating a meal, does not constitute a residence. I'm not sure it constitutes a dwelling. People, and you could talk about a crack house for that, people stay places. Those are not their residences. That's where they are temporarily being. A rental for a weekend for a lake property is just that. You're staying there for a period of time for recreational purposes and not for single-family residential purposes. Looking more into the business element of it, I don't think there's any question that vacation rental by owner, Airbnb, home away, those types of rental vehicles, if you will, constitutes a commercial purpose. The fact that they're renting it through that, setting out daily rates, how many people can occupy the property, how many cars you can have, what you can and can't do. You can't be told what you can and can't do if you're residing in a property, because then it would be yours. And here, all of those things are true. The I'm going to touch on these things, not that I think they're as important as the other elements of this case, but the appellants have raised issues of waiver, saying that other things were going on in the neighborhood that my clients and most of the homeowners did not even know were going on, alleged business activities. I'm not sure there's been any real proof that those do exist, but they are mentioned in their brief, and I wanted to address that. Latches, they waited too long to bring the suit. Well, they started this in February. They sent notices in July when they realized what they were doing, and then subsequently filed suit, all in a period of about 7 months. I don't think that constitutes latches on any level. Unclean hands, they attempt to suggest that because some parties in the subdivision may have had garage sales, that that constitutes a commercial use, and therefore everyone is guilty of operating a commercial venture. We talk about the Munson case, the Tarr case, and the Bernard case. And those are the three main cases in which the courts, various courts, I think two from San Antonio, one from Beaumont, those three cases all dealt with the issue of single-family residential purposes. That was kind of the crux of the three. They all were decided in favor of the restrictive covenant, of maintaining the restrictive covenant.
Is it your position that Zagga Bay was wrongfully decided, or can you
just... Yes, it is. I think it's a red herring. I think that the court focused on things that really don't fit into this case. I don't think it was correctly decided on the facts of that case, but I don't get paid the big bucks, so I don't get to say. But I don't think it's applicable here. I think it is not in keeping with what other courts of appeals have done on that issue. There are certainly other courts that may have not found in favor of the restrictive covenant, but not on this issue. There's been architectural review boards or I can't even remember, ACC, anyway, that they may have found other things. There's fence cases, setback lines, various other kinds of violations that for different reasons have been upheld in favor of the homeowners rather than the restrictive covenant. But on this issue, these three cases have been very consistent in sticking with the restrictive covenant. And again, the Zagby, and I do think this is significant, that the Zagby case, the restrictive covenants were written in 1999 instead of 1967. We had a complete world change in that time frame. And I don't think you can use the same standard of review in looking at those without taking into account what the framers had and what their intents were. There has been a question as to what this court's position has been with respect to how to interpret restrictive covenants, primarily Reed and the Hoover case. And maybe, as opposing counsel suggests, I'm intentionally ignorant on that. But I don't think that the two are comparing apples and apples, and I don't think that this court intended for that to be a firm, apply in every case situation. The last thing I'd like to touch on quickly is that the bond, appellants claim that the bond is insufficient. It is our position that the testimony given by Mr. Garrett was so speculative as to what he might charge in the future to rentals that had not been booked, and even rentals that had been booked, which were subject to cancellation, would determine the damages that he potentially would be entitled to. It's our position that he is entitled to no damages because the activity that from which he would be gaining income is inconsistent with the deed restriction, and we would request that the court sustain the temporary injunction and the bond in this case. Thank you.
Rebuttal? Yes, sir.
Thank you. I would just call the court's attention again to footnote 4 in the, I don't know how you pronounce it. I'm calling it Zagby. It could be way off, but in the footnote 4, in the last part of that footnote, the Austin Court of Appeals noted, literally in the footnote, that Blacks defines residence as, quote, living in a given place for some time, close quote, or as a, quote, house or other fixed abode, a dwelling, and notes that it usually, quote, just means bodily presence as an inhabitant, close quote, whereas domicile usually requires bodily presence plus an intention to make the place one's home. And that is contrasted to other definitions for residential purposes. I would also note that in the dissent that Justice Burgess wrote for the Beaumont Court of Appeals in the Bernard opinion, Justice Burgess noted that, quote, furthermore, a residential use restriction generally does not prohibit the use of property for duplexes, apartments, or condominiums. So, and then again, according to Justice Burgess, albeit in a dissent, noted that the distinction in Munson about motel tourist courts and trailer parks shall deem to be a business use, and the restrictive covenants only allowed residential use, was very important in his dissenting opinion.
I'm sorry.
Oh, sure.
I had a question about this idea of paying basically a hotel tax. I mean, I understand your position that because the restrictive covenants contemplate that property can be rented, do you find any merit to the appellee's position that that may be so, but because the restrictive covenants here prevent commercial use, that by the mere fact that VRBO collects that kind of hotel tax, that this puts it in a commercial category?
I disagree with that, because if you are renting, you're paying income tax on your rental income. So now are we going to get into parsing various versions of taxes for, okay, well, this, you're paying income tax on your rental income. Well, you know, is that commercial, or is it a kind of a hotel tax? Is that commercial? And now we're getting into parsing taxes as to whether that is commercial or not. Again, my position is that because,
isn't,
yes.
Isn't an income tax personal in nature? If you're paying personal income tax, that's distinguishable from a commercial hotel tax, isn't it?
Well, I don't know about that, because a lot of people will set up special purpose entities for the rental of their investment homes. And then if they are just renting it out in that nature, then there's going to be a tax to that entity for the rental income earned by that entity. So I would disagree with that position on the commercial motel hotel tax for that reason. And I would go back to the precedent that we have, that we're working with, of whether residential is ambiguous. If it is, I think that is decisively in my client's favor. If it's not, then if the court still finds that there is rental activity allowed on this property, then what the plaintiffs are asking this court to do is to legislate, rather than go through the amendment process for these restrictive covenants and have the residents amend them in the way that's contemplated there, and instead have the courts do it by adding terms on the duration of the rental and who can be there, whether they're relatives or not relatives. Keep in mind, the Garretts themselves have invited large groups and gatherings over when they were using their own property for anniversary parties and the like. So the use here, I think, does not meet the definition of commercial. This is a residential use, whether it's by the person who is rented, the lead person that is being rented from by the Garretts or the Garretts themselves. This does not fall into the realm or the context of commercial purposes. People are using the facility, the house, to dwell in. The question is it the duration prohibited or not? And the restrictive covenants are silent on the duration. The restrictive covenants are not silent on rental activity or rental income that's derived from the rental, because it contemplates the ability to rent the property. With respect to the bond, I'm hoping that becomes a moot point. But my time is up. So thank you for your time, panel.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you both very much for your arguments to the court today. We appreciate it. Your case is submitted, and the court will be adjourned.